Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today, we preview the September 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. We also talk about the approval of Eylea HD, or high-dose aflibercept. This article set can be found online at retinalphysician.com, focusing on intravitreal injection therapy, very relevant given that we are recording this right after the approval of Eylea HD. Remember, you can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. And while we no longer offer CME for episodes, for older episodes, you can claim CME by clicking on the link in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the September 2023 preview of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com and is also published in print for free available. And joining me for this recap of this issue, I've got three of my colleagues from around the country. You know, if we did I have to go and look at my list of podcast contributors. Maybe I have implicit bias. I did all this implicit bias training for my new job. And maybe my implicit bias is that almost all the podcast contributors have letters towards the end of the alphabet for their last names. And I don't think about it until I have to do the roll call. But everyone is behind me in the alphabet. So in alphabetical order, first, Dr. Kat Talcott, who's in Cleveland.
It's nice to see you. I don't think I've ever gone first in terms of alphabetical order for a group. So. It's a great day.
Neither has Dr. Akshay Thomas, who's in Nashville, Tennessee.
Thanks. How's it going, Jay?
And Akshay didn't humor me. Sorry. And last but not least, Dr. Josh Ewer has certainly never been first alphabetically in any group in his life.
No, I haven't. I'm used to being last.
And Josh is in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on the Jersey Shore. So, okay. So we got three articles to cover. Before we do that today, we're recording this August 22nd, 2023. Again, this episode will release early September, so it might be dated, but it would be remiss to not mention, since we mentioned it when it wasn't approved, that high-dose Eylea or Eylea HD, aflibercept 8 milligrams, was approved by the FDA. That was approved just before the weekend. It seems like everything exciting in retina happens before the weekend or during a holiday or just at a time, which is probably when the markets are frozen, is maybe why. But I don't know if the FDA cares. So maybe that's just when they finish a coffee break, come back and make a decision at 6 p.m. on Friday, August 18, 2023. So it was approved for the treatment of AMD, wet AMD, DME, and diabetic retinopathy. Based on the Pulsar and Photon trial, and it was approved for immediate dosing starting at 8 week and up to 16 week intervals following 3 initial monthly doses. Any quick thoughts, reactions, Kat? We had talked about it when it wasn't approved. I think most people were surprised. Now it is approved. Seems like they sorted out whatever the manufacturing issue was. Quick thoughts on what you see as the future of this drug, 6 to 12 months. What do you think is going to happen in the retina space?
Yeah, I thought it was anticlimactic, the approval after not getting approval. It seems like, oh, right, there's that one. I think it'll be interesting to see the use of it. I mean, I hope it's nice to have another option in terms of sort of durability and for like our resistant patients, but it'll be sort of interesting to see how people integrate it into their practice in terms of like now we have a lot of agents, I think. You know, like how do you jump from you're using Eylea, how do you jump from that to Hylia? Like, where do you put it in your pecking order? It'll be interesting to see how people integrate that.
You call it Hylia?
Yeah, Hylia.
Hylia. Hylia means something else from where I come from. Josh knows this. If you're from Miami, Hylia is something different. it's a suburb in Miami. But Josh, besides...
If you're from Cleveland, Ohio, then it's a eye drug medication.
Okay. Well, Josh, thoughts on this? I mean, I know you've been practice. It adds, I guess, to the... I mean, are you think you guys are going to stock with two types of Eylea? It feels like you get confusing from like mixing up medications. You have to be careful.
Yeah. Well, that might be true. I mean, I'm excited about it, you know, as Kat said, especially for patients who are treatment resistant. And we already do have some good options and some durable options, but I always welcome having, you know, another option. You know, another thing I think is nice about this is we're already familiar with Eylea. You know, most of us use it frequently, and obviously anytime there's a new drug on the market, there's concern and that I think leads to maybe a slower than expected uptake of its use. So maybe people will feel more comfortable from this off the bat. I guess they're manufactured differently because clearly there was some sort of manufacturing issue that, as you said, has now been resolved, but I couldn't really get an answer for why that's not a problem with the regular dose Eylea that we already have. So maybe it's not manufactured in exactly the same way, but regardless, I think the fact that many of us use Eylea and now have a version that seems more durable is exciting.
I started laughing, not because anything you said was funny, but because as you started talking about the manufacturing being different, I won't say which retina specialist it was in my head, but I had this image of a retina specialist in like a Willy Wonka outfit, like in front of the factory. And there's like the regular Eylea room, and then there's like the high dose Eylea room, and they're just two different manufacturing. I don't know. I could map this all out. It'd be a really boring short movie that no one would watch. Akshay Thomas, you want to know where the FAs were buried, right?
No, I think what I'm interested in is going to be how the durability data pans out in real life, because you know, what's fascinating is that, you know, in these studies, you know, retreatment criteria is different, you know, based on the study you look at, right? It's different in Pulsar than it was in Smile and Lucerne. So, you know, if I'm very curious to see what percentage of patients end up making it truly out to that 12 to 16 week time frame. I'm hoping a whole bunch, but we'll wait and see.
Yeah, and it dovetails really nicely with the topics we're going to talk about, because I think that for years, when I was ophthalmology resident and a fellow, people kept talking about how, like, yeah, we only have like a couple of drugs, but it's going to get really crazy soon. We're going to have a lot of options. And the model for that was oncology. You know, oncology in the 80s was basically you had a few drugs that all had horrible side effects, and you threw them at patients, and you kind of threw the same drugs at every cancer. But then once you started getting one monoclonal antibody and a second monoclonal antibody, it just gets exponential, right? The growth is not linear. It's actually exponential in terms of options. It gets really, really complicated. And there are very well-defined protocols in oncology for what is treated with what from a drug standpoint. We don't have that. And that's something we're going to talk about. The first article we're going to talk about is biosimilars. And it was written by Angela Lee, an ophthalmology resident at Duke, and Sharon Feckert was the senior author, also from Duke. And they talk about the current landscape of anti-VEGF biosimilars. Again, we're not going to do exhaustive reviews. I'm just going to summarize so we can talk about as a jumping off point. They talk about sort of the spending and the costs for anti-VEGF. Interestingly enough, and I'll come back and comment on this, they say that the costs resulted in the rapid development of anti-VEGF biosimilars. I'm going to come back to that because I don't know if it's that the company started making biosimilars to save money, but that is something that was stated here. They talk about the definition of biosimilar, a biologic that is highly similar to and has no clinically meaningful differences from an FDA-approved biologic. They talk a little bit about the process and how these are made, and then they talk about some of the approved options. So you have FDA-approved biosimilar for ranibizumab, includes BioViz from Biogen, Samsung, Bioepsis, and then you have biosimilars in the pipeline, right? You have Ranuzolrel, you're going to test my speaking, and then you have multiple other biosimilars that are going to come up. And of course, there's also Cimerli, which has gotten approval, and that is also from Coherus Biosciences. You also have Eylea biosimilars coming through. Maybe we'll have a high-dose biosimilar for Eylea down the line, who knows? And then they talk a little bit about concerns about biosimilars. One is that maybe they have the potential to reduce the burden of treatment, but many people have felt they need more info before using biosimilars. There's a lot of concerns about safety and efficacy, immunogenicity. And then the real question is, you know, the number of trials you need to get a biosimilar approved is less. It's half of what you would need for a regular drug. You know, Kat, I'll start with you. You know, I think it's fascinating, first of all, that they started with a premise that biosimilars came because of the high cost. It is sort of true. You know, companies will fill a niche in the market. The niche was, hey, these drugs are really, really expensive. If you can come up with a more less expensive option that works just as well, then you can do really, really well as a company. I mean, that's really what this is. This wasn't a purely benevolent venture by any of these companies. It wasn't a charity, but it may potentially reduce costs of the system, although we've talked a little bit about whether that will be true if there's FDA-approved Avastin, which we will leave aside for now. By the time this episode releases, we will know if they're FDA-approved Avastin, but we'll save that conversation for a different day. Kat, you're a busy academic institution. Like, what is sort of the thought process from the attendings and fellows and people you see about biosimilars? Are most people at this point open to using them? Are people still skeptical? And what are your own thoughts about biosimilars and how you'd fit them into your practice? Let's say if there was not an insurance or payer mandate to use a biosimilar.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I think I feel like probably like a lot of us do, is that there's just a lot of uncertainty and like not being like familiar or trust in the process by which a biosimilar sort of gets approved. Like, it's a lot less rigorous of a process than I think we're used to with sort of having two standardized phase three studies where lots of people are getting injected and we have like years of worth of safety data. I think that comes especially to mind given sort of recent approvals and recent safety concerns that have arisen sort of post-approval. So it's hard to really sort of trust the process here. You know, I think as you alluded to, I think the thing that's really going to force you to behave in a certain way is what insurance forces you to or what your sort of practice model does. Like I'm at a large academic institution. We are predominantly, we start people on Avastin and then we sort of switch them over to whatever. And we lose money on medications for which other people get rebates. So we haven't used biosimilars at all. We just recently had a conversation about whether or not it would make sense to stock it because one of our insurers was mandating that we sort of step through one on our way to, you know, Eylea or whatever. And we resisted for now because we felt like the rules are going to change in 6 months by the time the new insurance cycle comes around. So I think we as an academic facility are pretty immune to it. It's hard to envision, even though we have a large institution, how you're going to fit all these things into fridge space, first of all, and how you're going to keep track of sort of doing all the approvals for it. So yeah. To be honest, you know, I think like a lot of people, I have concerns about that process, and it's still, I think the market sort of forces us to. I can't see us in a large academic center changing too much. But as you mentioned, you know, if there's a FDA approved Avastin, that significantly changes what we do.
Yeah, Josh Ewers from Philly, so he knows all about trusting the process. So Josh, you know, what are your thoughts on this in terms of utilization? You know, Kat referenced again some of the skepticism. I think, Josh, I mean, I don't know if you guys have encountered this in Pennsylvania or Jersey, like a lot of this will be sort of driven by payers ultimately, because I don't think there's an incentive to Kat was alluding to this. There's no real incentive for a practice to change their patterns, change their storage, change anything. I mean, if you're a provider who's been out 25 years, why would you change your practice patterns? There has to be something to push you, especially if there's no additional benefit beyond cost savings for the system. So probably it would be payer driven that will get people comfort. Is that something that's been an issue yet in the Mid-Atlantic, or has it been kind of still something that's slow adoption?
Well, it's starting to become an issue. We just received word that two of the insurers who some of our patients use will now require double step therapy with Avastin first and then BioViz and then third agent. So one of those was already effective as of August 1st, and the other insurer is going to be effective as of September 1st. So it's already here. And, you know, Kat was saying that they, in a large academic institution, maybe you can resist that a little bit. But in private practices, especially smaller practices, I mean, you know, we don't really have much recourse. So we are now going to start stocking BioViz. We weren't planning to, and we probably wouldn't otherwise. And I would imagine that, you know, there's more of these in the pipeline. In the near future, there's probably going to be many of these biosimilars available. It's going to be a real challenge logistically. To figure out which ones to stock, how much to buy, you know, especially for smaller practices. So I think the insurers are going to drive a lot of this. They already are, and it's just going to get even more complicated, you know, soon.
You know, Akshay, I think it also is interesting from someone who, again, you're in training during this era, like, yeah, the classic argument, and Kat knows this because her chair is Dan Martin. Dan Martin was heavily involved in the Kat trial. You know, the classic argument was Avastin Lucentis back in the day, right? It was like on-label, off-label, compounding pharmacy issue. Is it equivalent? Is it not inferior? There are multiple kind of negatives there, and you had to kind of read through them, cross out every two ends, nose to know which one was true. But a lot of the argument back then was like, oh, like this person wants to use on-label because they're financially incentivized, and this person wants to use off-label because they're not financially incentivized. But it was really murky. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens here, right? Because we like to think no one has biases. We all have our biases, all four of us on this call, and we try to be as open and transparent about them. But if someone listens to me enough, they're going to see certain things that come up over and over again, just like if they listen to you or Kat or Josh. Same thing happens when we list the KOLs on the podium. And so it'll be really interesting to see now that it's not binary, or I guess a try with Eylea, Lucentis, Avastin, where it's kind of like this in between. It's not off label, it's on label. It could be financially less profitable or lucrative for your practice or institution. At the same time, it could be more depending on the program that you sign up for with the company, the rebates, et cetera. It is kind of interesting to sort of see it. In my mind, I always view it as a litmus test to sign and say, okay,
where do people actually stand on this issue, right? Because we don't know complete safety data, as Kat said, about this. But if you say it's equivalent, and we don't know that, but let's say it's equivalent, then there is actually no difference, then everyone should be using it. I mean, from a system standpoint, just like everyone should be using off-label Avastin. The whole argument against off-label Avastin was compounding safety, and then is it as efficacious, let's say, for DME? You know, it wasn't really shown for other indications. Like, from a national perspective, Akshay, do you think we're going to reach any sort of consensus, like in terms of, because again, like I said, I don't think oncology is perfect consensus, but they have some sort of protocols. They're like, hey, for this cancer, first line is this group of drugs and second line is this group of drugs. And it's pretty well defined, I feel, when I talk to my oncology colleagues. We don't have that. We still have a lot of sort of disagreement when it comes to that, even though we have a much simpler organ to deal with in some ways than these people dealing with whole body cancers. Do you think we're going to reach some sort of consensus, or do you think it's just going to get more like, I just can't imagine how confusing it has to be for like a first year resident right now who wants to go into retina. And then in 3 years, they're going to be an attending clinic and they're going to have to deal with 15, 20 injectables. And there's no consistency attending to attending in terms of who does what.
Yeah. I think all of us don't think there's going to be a consensus. I mean, you know, with three agents, we didn't have a consensus. I doubt we're going to have a consensus as we get like 6 to 10 agents. I mean, but in part, it's driven by all the things that you, Kat, and Josh have mentioned, which were all kind of different practice models where there are certain things that, you know, are just out of our hands, right? And some are just kind of built into the insurers. But I think one thing that is probably universal for all of us is that we're not going to do anything that is going to put a patient at risk, right? That kind of jeopardizes where there's too much safety data. So I think at least in the front end, you know, we might find ourselves painted in a corner where we're almost required to kind of use a biosimilar just because of, like Josh said, double step edits and so on and so forth, where we're just going to have to, we're kind of being forced in some ways to use it when we might, some people might say, hey, well, I want to wait like, you know, a year to see what the national data is like before I start employing this agent, where we might not have that opportunity to do so just because insurers are basically requiring for us to do it now. I mean, biosimilars, even though they're new in the eye space, I mean, we've obviously had them in the onc space and the rheumatology space for a long time. And you know, I'm not going to say I'm some expert in using systemic biosimilars, but I've had enough patients know that even though on average, you know, I don't see like these large, you know, variances in treatment response. There's some patients that were stable forever on Remicade and, you know, just had a variable response with when they were required to switch to biosimilar. So it's definitely not a one-size-fits-all. So we'll just have to wait to see how this pans out. I mean, there's some safety data presented on, you know, several thousand doses at ASRS, but I still think we need larger data sets over many more months to really kind of confirm the similar safety profile to the originator drugs.
Yeah, and it goes back to what Josh was saying about treatment resistance. There's another write-up here that is about AMD that is treatment resistant, right? So and we've talked a little bit about this concept before, but again, it gets more interesting to what you were just alluding to, Akshay. More and more options from a patient perspective could be good, right? You could have more than one thing to throw at a patient, especially when there's some individual variability in terms of how well someone responds to one drug or another. And that's managing treatment of resistance and neovascular age-related macular degeneration by Asad Durrani and Yoshio Nakawa. And so they talk about how people don't actually know why some people are treatment resistant. Some of it may be misdiagnosis. Some of it may be that there are other cytokines involved. They talk about the concept of tachyphylaxis, which again has been debated for a long time, or tolerance. And so what do people do? So they talk about what are people's strategies. Oftentimes people will switch to avoid the tachyphylaxis, to try to switch to a new drug after successive changes. They go through some of the data in terms of that, in terms of switch data. They talk about these newer options, brolucizumab, obviously, which was used for a period of time before the issues with IOI, faricimab. Now we'll have high-dose Eylea, what we referenced earlier. Some people have gone to increasing the dosing past Q4, like Q2 dosing, and we can talk a little bit about that. You can't really achieve that with payers, but if someone was paying out of pocket or using samples, you could achieve that. And I'm curious if you have seen that or have done that in your practices. Steroids, you know, aqueous suppression, Jason Hsu and I published on that idea, and others have published on the idea, PDT. I mean, you can kind of throw the kitchen sink at some of these patients. And there are always some patients who always have some degree of fluid and or resistance to treatment. So actually, we're going to circle back. You know, treatment resistance, is your strategy going to significantly, like, what is your strategy, right? So like, take us through, let's say you started with Avastin first line, and then it doesn't work. Then where do you go? And then where do you go? And let's say I'm that patient, and I'm not getting better. Like, what is your strategy for someone who's completely treatment resistant and assume there's not polypoidal or CSR or something else going on?
Yeah, I mean, so if they have neovascular AMD and they're treatment resistant, after Avastin, I'll usually go to Eylea. And usually I'll give them like 3 doses and kind of see how they respond. Unless they're getting worse, I wouldn't make a switch until I've at least tried 3 doses. And at this point, my algorithm would then be to go to faricimab. I mean, I think that some people have published, and there's some data that I've seen personally, at least in wet AMD, where I've had patients that have residual fluid that seem to have a decent response. I can't comment on the durability yet because I haven't treated them enough, but at least in terms of drying, I've done that. There may come a point where we, find ourselves, going straight to faricimab. I'm not there yet. So for me, it would still be Avastin to aflibercept and then to faricimab. For DME, it's a little bit different. I sometimes would probably be quicker to pull a steroid on board. But with AMD, that's kind of my algorithm.
Pat, how about you? Similar? Anything different?
Yeah. No, I think very similar overall. I think the other thing that can sometimes be helpful is, especially if you're seeing someone sort of every 4 weeks and there's like persistent fluid, sometimes I think it can be helpful to bring them back a little sooner. So to just bring them back like once after 2 weeks to see, does the fluid actually go away and it's just wearing off in that patient? That can sort of help you. I think that's another thing that I try. And then I just try and sort of, always keep in mind, like, am I missing the diagnosis, mm-hmm. Sometimes we have these people who we're like, is this CSR? Is this an occult like CNV? Like, I may be more likely to get like some OCTAs on those people, make sure that or like an FAF to make sure it's not some other diagnosis that's not going to respond very well. But those are the other things that I would add, but overall very similar.
To that point, Kat, I think the other thing people have talked about now with modern technology, you could try to get like an OCTA immediately post-injection, like a week out, 2 weeks out, and just see mm-hmm. is there regression of the CNVM? Because in theory, if it regresses, you expect the fluid to go away. Let's do some RPE dysfunction. Josh, any other thoughts? Like, now you introduced biosimilars, Eylea HD, like obviously step therapy again may influence what you have to do, but do you have any other thoughts about what you try for those resistant patients? Have you encountered these in your practice so far?
Yeah, I mean, my algorithm right now is pretty much the same. I am excited about the Eylea HD or Hylia, as Kat called it. I think I'm more likely to incorporate that into my algorithm than, some of the other stuff like biosimilars. But faricimab is sort of the thing I go to when I'm struggling, and I have tried multiple different agents already. But now, I think I'll probably play around with the Eylea HD for that as well. But, I agree with Kat too. If I'm not getting a response, then I'm always also reconsidering the diagnosis or trying to make sure that I'm not missing something.
Yeah. And it goes into our last article here, which it isn't as sexy or as groovy as talking about all the injections that we can do that are super expensive. But, it's a conversation that will come up from time to time, which is about prevention, right? So it's called systemic medications and lifestyle factors in AMD. Demetrius Gondra, the senior author, John Moir is the first author. I can't tell if it's pronounced French-wise or English-wise. So just to review, they talk about some things that have been published, including from this group, about systemic medications that may influence AMD, including metformin. They talk about there is some evidence in case control studies that metformin may reduce the risk of AMD development. However, that has been very difficult to replicate in terms of other studies showing the same result. And there's kind of the jury's still out on whether metformin helps. Same thing goes for statins. Some people have said it may reduce the risk because of the risk factors that are kind of associated with obesity and hypertension. And drusen are lipid rich. However, it seems again that the jury is still out. They talk about the best evidence coming from this RCT from Geimer, which looked at randomizing patient to a statin or not. However, it's very small numbers. I mean, you're talking about 114 patients in one of these series, and then a case series by Vavas at Mass on your 26 patients. So again, we don't know. There's a trial that they talk about being set up and using atorvastatin, but we don't really know. And then levodopa, which is used for Parkinson, they talk about some of the evidence there. And there is a clinical trial. They said it should be done because there's a mechanism, but there isn't much clinical data, just some preclinical data. And finally, lifestyle interventions. I mean, we think we all know about smoking, but nutrition, I mean, this is a question that comes up every single day, Kat. I mean, patients are always asking, like, what do I need to eat? What do I need to drink? And we've been told to talk about green leafy vegetables, and Alan Ho and fellowship used to talk about grab everything in the supermarket that has a different color, right? Lots of colored vegetables. They talk about the Mediterranean diet, but again, these things are probably good for general health, but and they talk about maybe there's some things with the gut microbiome. So yeah, like I think this is a good summary. I think everyone should read this. The problem that's frustrating about it, even though it's honest, is a lot of this is still sort of up in the air, which is why our recommendations for AMD, I feel, haven't really changed over the last 15 years from a dietary or systemic medication standpoint. The other things that obviously come up, Kat, Plaquenil, I get asked sometimes if patients with early AMD or history AMD can go on Plaquenil. You can comment a little bit on what your thoughts on there are there. What do you tell your patients regarding nutrition for AMD?
I mean, I actually feel like it's changed a little bit after reading this article. I usually kind of don't spend too much time on it and just say green leafy vegetables. You know, I'm sure like you guys do, I sometimes get some people who have a family history or who have like a druze or two who are already on AREDS. And I'm kind of like, there's not good data to suggest that you need to be on this, that it's going to provide you sort of any benefit. And I just sort of say, you know, if it were me and it makes you feel better to take it, take it. But if it's causing you an upset stomach, it feels like it's too much, just make sure you're eating green leafy vegetables. But I mean, I think maybe I should launch into a little bit more about like Mediterranean diet. Maybe I can break out the different colors from Dr. Ho from like fellowship. But I mean, it just highlights that like, this is where we really need an intervention, right? Like we need treatment that prevents people from going from like intermediate AMD to like GA or wet AMD. And we need to be able to hopefully have something that we can offer people when they're earlier stage to progressing. It's just the article is frustrating because there's, you know, everything's all the papers that I've looked at this are conflicting in terms of medication other than sort of just general diet stuff.
Akshay, I'm curious, beyond your AMD patients, what about your uveitis patients? Do you extend anything? Sure, you get asked about anti-inflammatory diet, curcumin, things like that by some motivated patients.
Jay, you know me too well. I was going to shamelessly plug the uveitis regardless of whether you asked me about it just now. So,
we've been playing this game together too long. We're on the same wavelength.
That's right. But I mean, you know, Demetrius Glandrophebulin and others are obviously looking at the gut microbiome and a variety of conditions, AMD, uveitis. And, you know, I have patients that ask me all the time, like, hey, would it be helpful for me to be on an anti-inflammatory diet? And, you know, and I tell my AMD patients the same thing as I tell my patients, it's probably not going to hurt. I mean, you know, the same things that are good for your heart are probably good for your eyes. And at best case scenario, we're improving your cardiovascular health. The worst case, we're not helping anything. We're certainly not hurting anything. You know, I think the therapeutics will have to pan out and we'll see how they do, you know, or that, but we know that if there's some sort of magic recipe that ends up being like the, you know, the fix for AMD, we will end up prescribing, but it's probably not gonna be a one size fits all. I think we know very well with gut microbiome data, it's very much patient dependent. And so again, just like anything else that works for one patient might work with the other, but in the meantime, Mediterranean diet never hurt anyone. So it's something that I'll kind of bring up, but I won't like recommend per se.
Josh, anti-inflammatory diet, probably good for the retina specialist as well. Probably good for all of us to what Akshay and Kat are alluding to. Part of it is just the ease of implementation. To Akshay's point, it doesn't solve necessarily everything. Diet for AMD patients. The biggest question I guess from patients who don't have AMD but have a family history. They're like, oh, what should I do? Should I take AREDS? And I'm like, well, there's no real evidence. And diet-wise, it's probably good for all of us to not smoke and eat a really good diet and eat a Mediterranean diet. Any other comments regarding that diet? And do you ever get questions about systemic medications? I feel like that doesn't come up as often. I don't feel like patients really ask me. I feel like they're either on the medication or they don't want to take more medications. But I don't know what you think, Josh.
No, I don't get any questions about systemic medications other than AREDS, which you know patients ask about all the time. For patients who don't really have an indication for AREDS, have a few drusen or strong family history, they're often taking it anyway because it's over the counter. And I sort of tell them, well, if you're not having side effects from it and, you know, it's probably not hurting you, I think that's okay, but there's no strong evidence it's helping you. But regarding the diet, I like this article because I usually tell patients green leafy vegetables, spinach, kale, like nuts, like almonds, that kind of thing, fish. And I feel like that's kind of incohesive. So it's actually a lot easier to just say, hey, follow like a Mediterranean style diet. And it's like this overarching theme. So actually I think that makes it easier for me to guide them. And if there's some evidence, even if it's not, you know, overwhelmingly convincing that it's helpful, right. I agree that it's, you know, it's easy to recommend. And as everyone else has already said, you know, at worst, it just, it improves their overall health, right? And at best, yeah, it helps their vision.
Yeah, the other comment I would make is, and we've talked about this before with AMD studies, is the problem is you need so long to see differences in an AMD study. So even if you did, let's say, metformin or a randomized control trial, 1 or 2 years is probably not sufficient. And Kat, we already know from other experiences, just because the drusen go away, it actually doesn't mean the AMD is getting better. Sometimes actually that's the sign that AMD is progressing. So it's like, what do you use as your metric? It's got to, I mean, again, in an ideal world, I feel like the timeline's got to be minimum like 3 to 5 years for it to be worth anything. Unless we gain some sort of measure of retinal health that's beyond just the structure we see on exam or photos in the future, like a metabolic sort of sign that I'm sure the dry AMD companies would froth at the mouth to try to get their hands on something like that, but does not exist at this point. Yeah.
It'd certainly be hard to get someone to fund one of these long-term studies. You have to get like, you'd have to get like DRCR to fund it. But I'll tell Dan that when I see him next, that he should start doing these like nutritional studies for AMD, because like no pharmaceutical company is going to do it. You know, it's hard. It's going to be expensive and not a lot of money there, right?
Not a lot of money there. There's, you know, there's a lot of money in injectables. We spent the most time on injectables. There's not a lot of money in cheap nutritional things that get you to a better place in terms of your eye health. Well, guys, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for joining for this episode. We'll release this in September. So forgive us if on label Avastin is approved and everything we said is moot. I'm sorry. If on label Eylea HD, the FDA anticlimactically changes their mind again, then we won't have data on that. But thanks so much to our alphabetically challenged group, Kat Talcott, Akshay Thomas, Josh Ewer, Jay Sridhar, all here. And I do actually have to look at that now. I think that probably 80% of our cohort is beyond me in the alphabet. So now I'm really worried about, man, implicit bias training does have some value. It's good. It's great. All right, guys. Have a great day. Take care.
All right. Thank you.
Many thanks to our team for joining us for today's episode. Remember, listeners, you can find all our episodes online at retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. We have 403 episodes there, sorted by category and easily searchable. You can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and feel free to always reach out with episode ideas by emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com or clicking on the Contact Us link on our website. Thanks again to Drs. Talcott and Ewer. Thanks to our whole production team, Dr. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Minacasa. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Sridhar, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.